1 Samuel 28-29, the 21st talk in a series in 1 Samuel, was presented by David Crabtree on January 25, 2009, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2009. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed, in whole, for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be looking at 1 Samuel chapter 28 and 29 today. When we pick up the action here in chapter 28, Saul has been chasing David. Saul wants to kill David. David has been running from him for several years at this point. He is finally forced to go into the land of the Philistines. That's the only place left for him to go and escape from Saul's pursuit. So David has gone into the land of the Philistines. He has befriended the commander, the leader in Gath, the Philistine leader. And David has been going out on raids, because that's what you do when you're a soldier in those times, plundering and pillaging. But he has gone into the areas where Canaanites were still residing. He would come back, give some of the proceeds of his expeditions to the commander in Gath, but leading the commander in Gath to believe that he has been leading these raids against Israelites, against people from the tribe of Judah, his own tribe. So David has been deceptive in what he's been doing, but in so doing, he has gained the friendship of this commander, this Philistine commander in Gath. Now David has been with the Philistines for over a year, and the forces are kind of coming together for a big battle between the Israelites and the Philistines, and the rest of 1 Samuel is devoted to the events that lead up to that conflict and then the conflict itself. The chronology in the next four chapters is apparently not in order. The chapters don't come in chronological order. Chapter 28 is just before the battle happens. Chapter 29 goes back in time to when the Philistines are collecting and getting ready to march to the place where the battle occurs. 30 then is describing events that seem to be simultaneous with this big battle, and then 31 is the battle itself. So the author apparently has departed from chronological order, so there must be some other principle of organization that's at work here, and that other principle of organization, I think, is switching back and forth between Saul and David, and doing that in order to draw our attention to the contrast between these two people, that it's encouraging us to compare and contrast Saul and David. It has done that earlier in the text, and I think that's what's happening in these last four chapters as well. So as we look through, I would like to encourage you to be thinking about that contrast, and then I'll be talking about it at the end. First two verses of chapter 28. Now it came about in those days that the Philistines gathered their armed camps for war to fight against Israel. And Achish said to David, "Know assuredly that you will go out with me in the camp, you and your men." And David said to Achish, "Very well, you shall know what your servant can do." So Achish said to David, "Very well, I will make you my bodyguard for life." Apparently what's happening is the conflict between the Israelites and the Philistines has kind of come to a head. It's not clear. The biblical account doesn't make clear why they are fighting, exactly what is the nature of this conflict. But if looking at the map, the conflict is north of both Israel and Philistia. It will be up in the valley of Jezreel. The cities of the Philistines are on the south coast of Israel. So it's quite a ways from the valley of Jezreel where this battle takes place. And most of Israel is located south of that valley as well, but they're up in the hills rather than down on the coastal plain where the Philistines are. Apparently what's happening is it's a dispute over the trade route. That's what would make sense of the location of this battle. The Valley of Jezreel is the juncture of all of the trade routes that would go through Palestine. They would all in one way or another come through the Valley of Jezreel. So apparently that's what's being contested, is who's going to control the trade routes. And the Philistines, they inhabit these five cities on the coastal plain, but they were never able to come together and unify as one political entity. They always remained separate city-states that would, on rare occasions, come together as a unified front, but that was relatively rare. Generally speaking, they stayed separate and independent of one another. In this case, this conflict over the trade routes seems to have brought them all together. They've been able to put together a mass army with all of the Philistines represented, and they are going to go against the Israelites and take care of this once and for all. Achish is planning to go and participate in this. And he tells David that David and his men will be joining them and going into this battle, which must have made David a bit nervous. This would be David going against his own people, clearly something he would be reticent to do. So David's response to Achish is a bit enigmatic. He says, "Very well, you shall know what your servant can do." He's not saying what he will do. He's saying you will see what he can do. And it's not clear what David will do. Achish has great faith in David by this time. David has been serving him for over a year. Achish clearly trusts him implicitly. And Achish makes him his bodyguard for life. And the term for bodyguard means keeper of the head. The last Philistine whose head Dave kept was dead. Apparently that's just the title that he's got, keeper of the head for life. But clearly David is greatly trusted by Achish. And so that kind of, that we keep that in our minds as the events progress. The next section. Now Samuel was dead, and all Israel had lamented him and buried him in Ramah, his own city. And Saul had removed from the land those who were mediums and spiritists. So the Philistines gathered together and came and camped in Shunem. And Saul gathered all Israel together, and they camped at Gilboa. When Saul saw the camp of the Philistines, he was afraid, and his heart trembled greatly. When Saul inquired of the Lord did not answer him, either by dreams or by Urim or by prophets. Then Saul said to his servants, "Seek for me a woman who is a medium, that I may go to her and inquire of her." And his servants said to him, "Behold, there is a woman who is a medium at Endor." Then Saul disguised himself by putting on other clothes and went, he and two men with him. And they came to the woman by night. And he said, "Conjure up for me, please, and bring up for me whom I shall name to you." But the woman said to him, "Behold, you know what Saul has done, how he has cut off those who are mediums and spiritists from the land. Why are you then laying a snare for my life to bring about my death?" And Saul vowed to her by the Lord, saying, "As the Lord lives, There shall no punishment come upon you for this thing. Then the woman said, Whom shall I bring up for you? And he said, Bring up Samuel for me. When the woman saw Samuel, she cried out with a loud voice. And the woman spoke to Saul, saying, Why have you deceived me? For you are Saul. And the king said to her, Do not be afraid. But what do you see? And the woman said to Saul, I see a divine being coming up out of the earth. And he said to her, What is his form? And she said, An old man is coming up, and he is wrapped with a robe. And Saul knew that it was Samuel, and he bowed with his face to the ground and did homage. It starts out by restating the fact that Samuel is dead. That was already mentioned earlier in the text. But now Samuel is an important figure in this particular chapter, and we are reminded that he is dead. Not only is he dead, but he has been mourned and he has been buried. So it's been some time since he actually died. The setting is on the eve of the battle. The armies are both arrayed on opposite sides of the Valley of Jezreel. The Philistines are on the north side of the valley, and the Israelites are on the south side of the valley on Mount Gilboa. From that location, the Israelites probably were able to see the Philistine army across the valley, and it must have been huge, and Saul is extremely scared by what he sees. It looks very ominous. It doesn't look promising for the Israelite army. Samuel's dead, so Saul can't inquire of Samuel, and it points out that Saul had removed from the land those who were mediums and spiritists. According to the law, the Deuteronomic law, spiritists and mediums were supposed to be stoned to death. They were supposed to be removed from Israel. And apparently Saul enforced that law. He knew the law, and he was enforcing that law. So the mediums and spiritists have been driven out of the land. So Saul's thinking, this looks ominous. I need to do what the kings of Israel are supposed to do before a battle, and that is consult God as to whether we are supposed to enter into battle and get his blessing on our efforts here. But Saul can't do so. Typically, what the king would have done would have been to go to the high priest. The high priest would have put on the ephod, which seems to have been a strip of cloth with pockets in it, and the pockets had the Urim and Thummim, and he would have used the Urim and Thummim to get God's response to their questions. Well, Saul had, remember when David fled Saul, David went to Nob where the priests were, and they helped David, and David fled. Saul found out about the fact that they had helped David, and he killed them all. Only one was able to escape. And in his escaping, he grabbed the ephod with the Urim and Thummim, and he went to David. So Saul had killed all the priests. Apparently what he did was establish new priests. And presumably they would have made a new ephod with new Urim and Thummim. And so Saul consults of those, of the new high priest with the Urim and Thummim. But there must have been some way that they could tell whether the Urim and Thummim was working or not. Now, I don't know how the Urim and Thummim were used at all. And no one apparently knows. They think that they were token-like things, like coins or something. And maybe they flipped them, like a coin toss. But nobody really knows. But presumably there was some way to tell whether it was working or not. I don't know what that would be, maybe best two out of three or whatever whatever it is, but some way you can tell how it's, whether it's working or not. And at this point in time, it's not working. The Urim and Thummim are not providing Saul with answers to his questions from God. Furthermore, he's not receiving dreams from God, and he's receiving no word from the prophets. So all of the standard means by which a king of Israel could hope to get communication from God, those aren't working, and Samuel's dead. So Saul is cut off from communication from God at this very critical moment in the history of Israel, and Saul is desperate. So Saul asks his servants, are there any spiritists around? Is there anybody here that could conjure up the dead? And his servants probably said, well, you know, you killed them all. But there is one that they know of, which is interesting. There is one at Endor that has not been killed. And so Saul, in the dark of night, disguises himself, and with just two other men, he sets out to go to visit this woman. He's disguised. Apparently, he's going through countryside, and it looks like he probably would have had to go past Philistine lines in order to get to where she was located. So he's sneaking around at night, hoping that he doesn't get caught and discovered. Goes and visits the woman, and when he comes to her, he says, could you bring somebody up from the dead for me? She's afraid that this is a trap. She's afraid that Saul and his men are trying to identify her as a spiritist and put her to death. So she's reluctant to say, yeah, I'll do it. Saul desperately needs to communicate with the dead. He wants to talk to Samuel, as we see. And he doesn't right off identify who he wants to be called up from the dead. But because the woman is reluctant, Saul swears an oath. He says, as the Lord, that is, as Yahweh lives, there shall no punishment come upon you for this thing. A curious oath to swear. He's swearing by God that he will violate God's commandments. So she is persuaded by this oath. He's taken this oath. She's willing then to do her art. And she says, who do you want me to bring to life? And he says, it's Samuel. So he wants to talk to Samuel. Apparently, he feels cut off from God, but he needs communication from God. So he goes to the man who was God's spokesman in Saul's life, for most of Saul's life, that is Samuel, someone that he knows personally, even though Samuel was the one who told Saul that he was condemned and that he would die. However, Saul knows Samuel to be one who genuinely cared for him. So that's the one that Saul chooses to go seek out, see if he can hear him from the dead. So the woman performs her art. And as soon as she does so, she says, she cries out with a loud voice. She saw Samuel and cried out with a loud voice. And then she says, why have you deceived me? For you are Saul. It's not clear why it is that as soon as she sees Samuel, that it becomes clear to her that this disguised man here is Saul. But that all becomes apparent to her, and she lets out a cry. Now, it's not clear to me why the cry, whether it's because now she's afraid because Saul's here and she might die, or whether there's something unusual about this appearance But something is out of the usual here, unordinary, and she's alarmed. And she is now aware that it's Saul that she has in her presence. Saul reassures her and says, "Don't worry, but tell me, what is it that you see?" And she describes this person. She describes his robe, an old man coming up. He is wrapped with a robe. And earlier she said, "I see a divine being coming up out of the earth." Saul knows immediately who it is. This is the right one that she has called up. And Saul, recognizing that it's got to be Samuel that she called up, he falls down to the ground, bowed down, and does homage to the prophet Samuel. Next section. Then Samuel said to Saul, "Why have you disturbed me by bringing me up?" And Saul answered, "I am greatly distressed, for the Philistines are waging war against me. And God has departed from me and answers me no more, either through prophets or by dreams. Therefore I have called you, that you may make known to me what I should do." And Samuel said, "Why then do you ask me, since the Lord has departed from you and has become your adversary? And the Lord has done accordingly as he spoke through me. For the Lord has torn the kingdom out of your hand and given it to your neighbor, to David. As you did not obey the Lord and did not execute his fierce wrath on Amalek, so the Lord has done this thing to you this day. Moreover, the Lord will also give over Israel along with you into the hands of the Philistines. Therefore, tomorrow you and your sons will be with me. Indeed, the Lord will give over the army of Israel into the hands of the Philistines." Samuel, when he first arrives, isn't particularly welcoming. He says, "Why have you disturbed me by bringing me up?" Saul explains to Samuel the situation and says, "Look, we're in a tough spot. I don't know what to do. I don't know if we should go against the Philistines or not. It looks bad at this point in time, but God won't respond to me. So I called you up. You've got to tell me what to do." And Samuel's response is, "Why then do you ask me, since the Lord has departed from you and has become your adversary?" That what Samuel had predicted would happen has indeed happened, that God has shut himself off from Saul. God has turned his back on Saul. And largely it's because Saul didn't care to be responsive to God. But it's Saul's resistance to obeying God. God has stopped communicating with him. Saul's questions for "what I should do, what should I do, God," weren't serious questions, in a sense. Samuel repeats, he says that everything that I had predicted has come to pass. And we'll go back and look at the passage. It's 1 Samuel 15 where that happens. And later on I'll read a section of that. But Samuel had predicted that that God would turn his back on Saul, and that his kingship would be given to another, that is David, and that has been coming true. Why? Because Saul had not carried out the punishment of Amalek as God had requested. As a result, Samuel says, "You will be turned over to the Philistines. Your whole army will be defeated. You and your sons will die at the hands of the Philistines in the battle that's going to happen the next day." Next section. Then Saul immediately fell full length upon the ground and was very afraid because of the words of Samuel. Also, there was no strength in him, for he had eaten no food all day and all night. And the woman came to Saul and saw that he was terrified and said to him, "Behold, your maidservant has obeyed you, and I have taken my life in my hands, and I have listened to your words which you spoke to me. So now also, please listen to the voice of your maidservant, and let me set a piece of bread before you that you may eat and have strength when you go on your way. But he refused and said, I will not eat. However, however, his servants, together with the woman, urged him, and he listened to them. So he arose from the ground and sat on the bed. And the woman had a fattened calf in the house, and she quickly slaughtered it, and she took flour, kneaded it, and baked unleavened bread from it. And she brought it before Saul and his servants, and they ate. Then they arose and went away that night. So Saul, as soon as he hears what Samuel has said, he's distraught, and he just throws himself on the floor. He doesn't know what to do. And not only is he distraught, but it says also there was no strength in him, for he had eaten no food all day and all night. It's not clear why he had not eaten any food. It doesn't say here. But we know earlier, from an earlier account, when they were going into battle, Saul made all of his soldiers take an oath that they wouldn't eat any food until they had defeated the enemy. It's possible that this is another one of Saul's religious acts, that he is fasting in preparation for the battle that is to come. The woman comes and she says, behold, your maidservant has obeyed you, and I have taken my life in my hand and have listened to your words which you spoke to me. So now also, please listen to the voice of your maidservant, and let me set a piece of bread before you that you may eat and have strength when you go on your way. She realizes he's undernourished, that that's at least part of the issue here, and she wants to provide him with food. She says, I think she's indicating, I have acted in good faith and in kindness towards you. Let me continue in that spirit. Let me provide you with food. He refuses to eat, and it could be then that this is a religious act that he is involved in, and he doesn't want to break that religious act. But she and Saul's servants insist that he ought to eat, and he eventually gives in. And she prepares a large feast, a fatted calf. That's a significant meal that she is preparing. She slaughters that and prepares a full meal, and they eat of it. And Saul and his servants all leave. That all happened during the night. While it is still night, they leave and go back to the army of Israel. Now things switch to David. Chapter 29. Now the Philistines gathered together all their armies to Aphek, while the Israelites were camping by the spring, which is in Jezreel. And the lords of the Philistines were proceeding on by hundreds and by thousands. And David and his men were proceeding on in the rear with Achish. Then the commanders of the Philistines said, what are these Hebrews doing here? And Achish said to the commanders of the Philistines, is this not David, the servant of Saul, the king of Israel, who has been with me these days, or rather these years, and I have found no fault in him from the day he deserted to me to this day? But the commanders of the Philistines were angry with him. And the commanders of the Philistines said to him, make the man go back, that he may return to his place where you have assigned him, and do not let him go down to battle with us, lest in the battle he become an adversary to us. For with what could this man make himself acceptable to his Lord? Would it not be with the heads of these men? Is this not David, of whom they sing in the dances, saying, Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s? So we have gone back in time chronologically. In this chapter, the Philistines are making their way to the Valley of Jezreel. And it's the whole alliance of all of the lords of the cities of the Philistines have gathered together, and they're proceeding by hundreds and by thousands. So this is a big army. Earlier on, when Israel was fighting against the Philistines, if I remember correctly, 3,000 was the number of soldiers that Israel was able to muster. presumably the Philistines have put together a larger, significantly larger army than the Philistines are able to put into the field. And David is in this procession of Philistines that are marching off to this war. And he is in the rear guard with his overlord, Achish. Well, the other Philistine commanders come to Achish and they say, "What are these Hebrews doing here?" The term Hebrew is a term that has been found in writings, dug up in writings, ancient writings from the area. And the Hebrews were, the term Hebrew refers to this eclectic group of people that were kind of cast-offs from all of the other societies that gathered together and were semi-nomadic and oftentimes made their living as mercenaries, soldiers. So it's a much larger category than just the Israelites. But foreigners often referred to the Israelites as Hebrews. So the Israelites were lumped into this category of these kind of cast-offs who wandered around and fought for a living. So they are referring to David and his men as Hebrews. Just as a side comment, the Israelites don't refer to themselves as Hebrews. They refer to themselves as Israelites. But it's foreigners referring to Israelites that oftentimes call them Hebrews. So they're saying, what are these Hebrews doing here? And they're raising this issue because, if you'll recall, a few chapters earlier, in about, I don't know, I think it was chapter 13 or 14 of this same book, there was a battle between the Israelites and the Philistines in which at first the Philistines were winning, but then the battle turned and the Israelites won and were able to rout the Philistines. And as they routed the Philistines, there had been some Hebrews who had been fighting for the Philistines, and they turned against the Philistines in that battle. And the rout became even greater than it otherwise would have been. So presumably these Philistine commanders remember back to chapter 13 or 14, and they say, "We will not allow this to happen again. We are not going to take Hebrews with us to fight against the Israelites." So what is David doing here? And Achish's response is, "Yeah, but these aren't your run-of-the-mill Hebrews. This is David and his men. And they have been fighting faithfully for me for years now. They have been time-tested, and there is no question but what they will be loyal to me." But the other commanders are saying, "I don't care. I don't care how long they fought for you. They're Hebrews. And what better way for Israelites that have been disaffected from their king to earn a place back into Israelite society than to turn on Philistines and kill a whole bunch of them? And furthermore, this is not just a typical Hebrew. This is David, and we know David's history. David has killed a lot of Philistines in the past, and we are not convinced that he would not do so again." So they insist that David be turned back, that he not accompany them on this particular battle, and that is what happens, as we see in the next section. "Then Achish called David and said to him, 'As the Lord lives, you have been upright, and your going out and your coming in with me in the army are pleasing in my sight. For I have not found evil in you from the day of your coming to me to this day. Nevertheless, you are not pleasing in the sight of the Lord's. Now, therefore, return and go in peace, that you may not displease the lords of the Philistines.' And David said to Achish, 'But what have I done? And what have you found in your servant from the day when I came before you to this day, that I may not go and fight against the enemies of my lord the king?' But Achish answered and said to David, 'I know that you are pleasing in my sight, like an angel of God. Nevertheless, the commanders of the Philistines have said, he must not go up with us to the battle. Now then, arise early in the morning with the servants of your Lord, who have come with you. And as soon as you have arisen early in the morning and have light, depart. So David arose early, he and his men, to depart in the morning, to return to the land of the Philistines. And the Philistines went up to Jezreel. So Achish comes to David and says, I trust you implicitly. There's no problem. But the other Philistine commanders say you can't come with us. So I want you to take your men and go back to Ziklag, the place where I have assigned to you, and you will not participate in this war. David says, but why not? What did I do? What have I done wrong? And Achish reassures him, you haven't done anything wrong, but this is just the way it has to be. I can't convince the other commanders otherwise. So he insists that David go back, and the next day that he not continue on to Jezreel with the rest of the army, and that's what David does. Now, this section is, I find, difficult. I mentioned last week that David's deception of Achish here is something that I find hard to understand exactly what's going on here and how we're to think about it. If David were to come to me and say, here's my situation, what should I do? That is, the situation being he has to go in. He can't stay in Judea anymore. He can't go to Moab. He can't go to the plains to the south. I can't remember the name of it right now. He can't go outside of Israel, or God sends him back in. The only place he has to go is into Philistia, and he doesn't want to go there. And when he does go there, the only way he can stay is to carry out this deception of the leader of the Philistines there. If he had come to me and asked me, is that what he should do? I'd have said, oh man, probably not. But it's not like I would have had a better suggestion for him. But I would have had a difficult time saying, yeah, that's the way to go. But I have lived long enough to know that life gets really complicated. That people find themselves in situations that in which there is no good way out, absolutely no good way out. There are only bad ways out. And I don't know what one ought to do in those situations. I know whenever I've counseled people in that kind of situation, I've said, you should do what you think is best. I mean, do things according to God's principles as best you can, as best as you understand them. And fall on your knees before God and ask for his mercy, because I don't know what you should do. And I don't presume to want to tell you what you should do in this situation. Over the years, I've become a lot humbler in those kinds of situations, because I don't know, and I don't presume to know. And I've realized that we have to give one another a lot of room to make your own decisions, to make even your own mistakes. And I always trust that God can, it is my great hope that God can extract us from the messes that we create for ourselves. I don't know whether what David did here is right to carry out this deception. I think there's no indication in the text that we're supposed to see this action as being wrong that I can find. I don't think that he's being condemned by the author for what he does here. But he is in a tough spot, and it's hard to know what he should have done. And his way out seems dicey to me. It would not have been one that I would have chosen. But what is David thinking? Now that he's got himself into this situation where he is under the lordship of this Philistine commander, and he's going to battle against the Philistines, I don't think David would ever have fought against the Israelites. But when it came right down to it, had he gone to battle, I don't think he would have fought against the Israelites. There's just too much evidence prior to this that he was so respectful of, certainly of Saul, the anointed king of Israel, but clearly of Israel itself and the people of Israel, that and he's avoided attacking them all along. I don't think he would have participated fighting against them with the Philistines in this situation had he gone with the Philistine army. The only thing I can think is that he is looking for an opportunity to break away. He's looking for an opportunity to actually help Israel. And my suspicion is he was thinking, I will go with the Philistine army, and when the time is right, I will fight for Israel against the Philistines. So when he's told that he can't go with the Philistines, he argues, why not? And the only thing I can figure is because he has convinced himself that he could actually be of assistance to Israel in this conflict, and that is what is set out for him. That's what God has prepared the way for. So I think he's actually truly disappointed that he's not going to battle. But apparently God has created another way out for David. He's not going to fight against the Israelites. He's not going to fight with the Philistine army. The Philistines won't allow it. David is going back home. So it's interesting. I think David went into Philistia because he had no other place to go. He didn't want to go to Philistia because he didn't want to become a part of that culture. But he has no other option the way he sees it. So he goes into Philistia and he becomes a part of Philistine society, but he doesn't embrace Philistine society and its values. And he was looking for an opportunity, some way for God to steer him through this situation and bring him out of it. Okay, there are a couple of things, comparisons, that I would like to talk about here. I think this section is inviting comparisons of people. I mentioned that it's inviting a comparison of Saul and David, and I'll talk about that in just a minute. But it's also, I think, inviting a comparison of Achish and Saul. Achish responds very differently to David than did Saul. Achish is very trusting of David. He trusts David implicitly, even though he really should not. That David has not given over his loyalty to Achish the way that Achish thinks that he has. Achish can see no wrong in David, can see no sense that David would be the least bit disloyal to him at all. What's curious is Achish is embracing an image of David, but not the David himself. He's embracing this image that he has created in his mind of David, not the true David. Had he embraced the true David, I think things would have looked very differently. I mean, if Achish had truly recognized who David was and his significance in what God is doing in history, that would have been a very interesting story, but that's not the story that we've got here. Saul, on the other hand, will not trust David no matter what. Saul won't trust David even though he should. That David is entirely loyal to Saul. But Saul can't see it. So it's curious that neither of them are seeing David for who he is. They are both blinded to who David is. And in both cases, it's to their own destruction that they fail to recognize David for who he really is. The other interesting contrast is between Saul and David. We have to recognize that in this, that Saul finds himself in a very difficult and even desperate situation. As Saul sees it, he is seeing his kingship kind of slipping out of his grasp. Slowly, but it's slipping away. And Saul senses that happening. That Saul sees David rising, and he rose in popularity. He was anointed. Saul's even been told that his neighbor will take his throne. And Saul's seeing all of that come to pass, and Saul desperately wants to hold on to his power and his position. And reading the situation through those eyes, he is very distrustful of David, wants to kill him, sees David as someone who's trying to usurp his throne from him. And God is no longer responding to Saul. So Saul is in a very desperate situation where things are slipping away and there's no place that he can turn for security. How does he respond to this situation? He seems to crave knowledge and certainty. There are a couple of passages where we've seen that Saul wanted certainty from the people of Ziph that David was there. Saul is looking for a word from God, some reassurance wherever he can and get it. For him to be reassured by God, he has to come to the place that he can entrust his eternal fate to God, can entrust his soul to God, and he can't do that. So he will always be without assurance. Saul is religious, and we've seen that all along. And I'll read a section of chapter 15 in just a second. He's religious, but he's not obedient. We've seen that he wants a word from God. He consults God as he was supposed to, carries out the fast, carries out religious rituals, but he's not obedient. His heart really isn't set on God and the things of God. And as a result, he can't relax in God. He doesn't truly want what God wants. Let's look at 1 Samuel 15. I want to go back to that. It's striking to read this now that we've covered more territory, I think. I'll start with verse 22. I'll read 22 through 31. Remember, this was what Samuel said to Saul right after he had been disobedient in their battle with the Amalekites, and he had not killed all of the men and women and all of the animals as God had asked him to do. So here's what Samuel said. Has the Lord as much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. For rebellion is the sin of divination, and insubordination is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king. Then Saul said to Samuel, I have sinned. I have indeed transgressed the command of the Lord and your words, because I feared the people and listened to their voice. Now, therefore, please pardon my sin and return with me, that I may worship the Lord. But Samuel said to Saul, I will not return with you, for you have rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you from being king over Israel. And as Samuel turned to go, Saul seized the edge of his robe, and it tore. So Samuel said to him, the Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to your neighbor who is better than you. And also the glory of Israel will not lie or change his mind, for he is not a man that he should change his mind. Then he said, I have sinned, but please honor me now before the elders of my people and before Israel, and go back with me, that I may worship the Lord your God. So Samuel went back following Saul, and Saul worshiped the Lord. What's interesting to me in reading, going back and reading this now, is Saul was devoted to God insofar as he was religious. He did the things, the religious ritual that was required of him. What he lacked was the willingness to truly embrace God's values for his own. So when Saul was told to wipe out the Amalekites, that's what God had told him to do, he did not do it because the people wanted to keep some of the stuff, in particular the animals. Saul consented to that, justified or rationalized in his own mind because, look, these animals can be used for sacrifices. So as long as it was religiously correct, Samuel was on board with that, but he didn't truly embrace God with his heart. And that's what he's condemned for. He didn't do what God asked him to do. Saul can't rest and can't place his soul in God's hands and just rest there. Saul is always looking for reassurance, comfort, security. And he can't get it because the only place that it's available is from God himself, and he doesn't trust God. And it's interesting then, as you look at Saul's progression, you don't see the same kind of self-reflection that you see in David. In David, you do see that, I believe. And I think there are hints of it in the text. There are certainly more hints of it in the Psalms. David tried to encourage Saul to be self-reflective. But Saul doesn't do it. He isn't contrite. You see moments of contrition, as here in chapter 15. But we saw moments of contrition with respect to David as well. That he would see, for moments, he would see that David was loyal to him. He would recognize that and recognize that he was wrong for seeing David as disloyal. But it only lasts an instant, and then it's gone. So there's no enduring contrition that takes place. It's just these flashes of it, of seeming contrition. There's no faith. He can't trust God. He can't find rest in God, and there's no peace. Saul essentially goes crazy trying to find the security and peace that he wants. David, on the other hand, was also in a difficult situation. We've talked about that a lot, that his life was threatened on a daily basis. And clearly it came to his mind, has God abandoned me? Just as Saul was wrestling with the question of whether God had abandoned him, David, given the circumstances, must have asked the same question himself. But David responds very differently. He throws himself at the mercy of God. And he consistently does that. He keeps seeking refuge in God. Somehow God will save me out of this. God will redeem the situation. But he's even driven to the extent of having to go into Philistia because he has no place else to go. He doesn't seem to have a plan exactly how he's going to cope there, but he just trusts that God will help him navigate through this. And God does. So he is faithful to God. He is faithful to God's anointed. David never does take the easy way out and kill Saul, even though he had opportunities to do so. He's always respectful of Saul and his position. As a result, there's a kind of, I'll use this term advisedly, there's a kind of carelessness with respect to David, a carefreeness. David is able to just forge ahead and allow God to help him see his way through. David, I think, is characterized by self-reflection, humility, contrition, and as a result, he finds peace even in the midst of all of this difficulty. Let me read just a few verses from Psalm 34. This one was written early on in the time when David fled from Saul. And I think it's interesting for the kind of spirit that it depicts David as having had at this time. Psalm 34, 15 through the end. David says, "The eyes of the Lord are toward the righteous, and his ears are open to their cry. The face of the Lord is against evildoers, to cut off the memory of them from the earth. The righteous cry, and the Lord hears, and delivers them out of all their troubles. The Lord is near to the brokenhearted, and saves those who are contrite in spirit. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers him out of them all. He keeps all his bones, not one of them is broken. Evil shall slay the wicked, and those who hate the righteous will be condemned. The Lord redeems the soul of his servants, and none of those who take refuge in him will be condemned." I think this captures the spirit of David. That is, his duty is to be loyal and faithful to God and to trust that God will take care of those that trust in him. And there's a peace that comes from that. Life will be difficult. He says, many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers him out of them all. That one way or another, when things are all said and done, there is salvation from all situations. That's what Saul can't come to that same point. Because Saul can't quite come to the place where he lets go of his own mastery of his own life and trust his soul to God. So I think when it comes down to it, it's that difference of contrition and humility on the part of David and Saul's inability to recognize that God must be the master of his life, and he can't turn himself over to God's loving kindness, actually. Okay. Questions and comments.
Do you feel that the actual spirit of Samuel appeared to Saul on that occasion? And if so, how does someone like the Witch of Endor have the power to disturb Samuel?
Mm-hmm. I'm inclined to take this at face value, that it was indeed the spirit of Samuel that she saw. And I think that happened because God brought that about. That's part of what God wanted to have happen in this story, that Saul would be confronted once again by God through Samuel, just as he had been earlier. And it's interesting, God is giving Saul lots of chances along the line to come to the place where he's down on his knees before God and repentant. And Saul can't really bring himself to do that and have it stick. He can do it momentarily, but he can't do it and have it stick. So I think that really was Samuel that appeared. Oh, absolutely. Because that's prohibited. That's prohibited in the Levitical code. Right. It is.
Because it's prohibited, it's still honored.
Yeah.
You know, God
yeah.
chooses to use this Witch of Endor
right.
to go between Saul and Samuel.
Right, right. Right. And in interesting, looking back at chapter 15 in 1 Samuel, let's see, he likens Saul's disobedience to divination. and idolatry. And he ends up doing the divination that was likened to. Mm-hmm. God uses all kinds of means to achieve his purposes.
Yes, so suppose that David had marched with the Philistines into battle. What do you think his course of action would have been?
I think he would have turned on them. I think what he was expecting is at some point in the battle, he would have seen the right time to turn on the Philistines and fight on behalf of the Israelites, and that he was just looking for that opportunity. I think he was counting on having that opportunity.
Thanks, David, for all the work you put into that. I had one question, David, on verse 19, and maybe you could comment. It says, I think this is Samuel speaking, "And tomorrow you and your sons will be with me." When theologians discuss the intermediate state of the soul, mm-hmm. could you comment on that before the cross? About the Old Testament saints? Uh-huh. And David and Saul is... maybe there's not appropriate time for this.
Well, do you mean... are you wondering what happens to the soul right after death?
Well, and Samuel speaking, it says, "Be with me." Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if that's the same place, or are you talking about the grave as Sheol there? I just wonder if you could comment.
Well, I'm inclined to think that it just means you'll be dead like I am. I am still undecided as to what Saul's eternal fate is. All the way through here, it seems to me he has lacked the characteristics that characterize someone who has come to the place where they understand who God is and are truly one of a believer. He has lacked all of those. He's never come to that point of contrition. But it doesn't take long to come to that point. And Saul is still alive. There's still time. And God keeps giving him opportunities. It's not clear to me, I mean, unless in studying for next week, I see something that I haven't seen up to now. I don't think we know for sure what his eternal destiny was. But I don't think here it's really telling us either way. I think all it means is you're going to be dead like I am. And that's all I'm seeing in it.
So I appreciate this too, David. And I've tried to figure out Saul and David, comparing them. Long years, but I appreciate, especially going back to chapter 15 and looking at how, okay, and thinking way ahead with David to where he really sinned and repented.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And said, "I have sinned." Well, and Saul did too.
Right.
But it kind of helps me think more about, well, then what was the next... How did the next shoe drop? With right. David, it was basically, you know, "Do whatever to me
right.
you're going to do, God."
Right.
And Saul was like, "Can I go back now and
yeah,
do this?"
Exactly.
The religious
exactly.
stuff.
I mean, as I was thinking about this, this is really sobering. Because true contrition isn't just bringing to yourself to the place where you say, "I'm sorry." That it's, and I think that there are, we see in the passages there are places where Saul says that in words that sound convincing, but he goes on and lives his life otherwise. That contrition is so fleeting in the narrative with respect to him that it's not contrition at all. It just appears to be contrition. Well, what is real contrition? And it has to be the enduring contrition that turns around and says, "God, whatever your will is, let your will be done, and I'm on board with that." on an ongoing basis. And it's difficult, I think. I mean, I even think about this in my life. I mean, have I come to the place where I am truly repentant of my sinfulness? And every time I try to sort that out, there's a sense in which I can't answer it because I can't get deep enough into my soul to really know. But whenever I go through that routine, I come back to the place where I say, God is a loving God. I want to be contrite. God, help me be contrite. And there's no more I can do. God, have mercy on me. And there's no more I can do. And it has to be a work of God that brings about that repentance and contrition. And I hope that the God who is there will bring that about in my life. Thank you.